Hi, and welcome to the Quilt Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Frances O'Rourke Dow, and today we'll be reading from Aunt Jane of Kentucky by Eliza Calvert Hall. This week, Chapter 9, The Gardens of Memory. Just a side note, I'm reading the abridged version of Chapter 9. It's a chapter that begins out with a lot of description and not much Aunt Jane, and I thought I'd get right to the point. Chapter 9, The Gardens of Memory. I don't reckon Solomon was thinking about flower gardens when he said there was a time for all things, Aunt Jane was wont to say. But anyhow, it's so. You know the Bible says that the Lord God walked in the Garden of Eden in the cool of the day, and that's the best time for seeing flowers, the cool of the morning and the cool of the evening. There's just as much difference between a flower with the dew on it at sunup and a flower in the middle of the day as there is between a woman when she's fresh from a good night's sleep and when she's cooking a 12 o'clock dinner in a hot kitchen. You think them poppies are mighty pretty with the sun shining on 'em, but the poppy ain't a sunflower, it's a sunrise flower. And so I found them when I saw them in the faint light of the summer dawn, delicate and tremulous, like lovely apparitions of the night that an hour of sun will dispel. With other flowers, the miracle of blossoming is performed so slowly that we have not time to watch its every stage. There's no precise moment when the rose leaves become a bud or when the bud turns to a full-blown flower. But at dawn, by a bed of poppies, you may watch the birth of a flower as it slips from the calyx, casting it to the ground as a soul casts aside its outgrown body, and smoothing the wrinkles from its silken petals, it faces the day in serene beauty, though the night of death be but a few hours away. And some evening, when the moon's full and there's a dew falling, continued Aunt Jane, that's the time to see roses, and to smell roses, too. And chrysanthemums, they're sundown flowers. You come into my garden about the first of next November, child, some evening when the sun's going down, and you'll see the white ones looking like stars and the yellow ones shining like big gold lamps in the dusk. And when the last light of the sun strikes the red ones, they look like cups of wine, and some of them turn to colors that there ain't any names for. Chrysanthemums just match the red and yellow leaves on the trees and the colors you see in the sky after the first frost when the cold weather begins to set in. Yes, honey, there's a time and a season for everything. Flowers, too, just as Solomon said. An old garden is like an old life. Who plants from youth to age writes a record of the years in leaf and blossom, and the spot becomes as sacred as old wine, old books, and old friends. Here in the garden of Aunt Jane's planting, I found that flowers were also memories, that reminiscences were folded in the petals and roses and lilies, that a rose's perfume might be a voice from a vanished summer, and even the snake gliding across our path might prove a messenger bearing a story of other days. Aunt Jane made a pass at it with her hoe and laughed as a little creature disappeared on the other side of the fence. I never see a striped snake, she said, that I don't think of Sam Amos and the time he saw snakes. It wasn't often we got a joke on Sam, but his tournament and his snake kept us laughing for many a day. Sam was one of them big blundering men, always giving Millie trouble, and having trouble himself just through pure carelessness. He meant well, and Millie used to say that if what Sam did was even half as good as what Sam intended to do, there'd be one perfect man on God's earth. One of his careless ways was scattering his clothes all over the house. Millie would scold and fuss about it, but Sam got worse instead of better up to the day he saw the snake. And after that, Millie said there wasn't a more orderly man in the state. The way of it was this. Sam was raising an embankment around one of his ponds, and Uncle Jim Matthews and Amos Crawford was helping him. It was one Monday morning after the 1st of April, and the weather was warm and sunny, just the kind to bring out snakes. I reckon there never was anybody hated a snake as much as Sam did. He'd been scared by one when he was a child and never got over it. He used to say there was just two things he was afraid of, Millie and a snake. That morning, Uncle Jim and Amos got to the pond before Sam did, and Uncle Jim hollered out, "Well, Sam, we beat you this time." Uncle Jim never got tired telling what happened next. He said Sam run up the embankment with his spade and set it in the ground and put his foot on to push it down. The next minute, he'd give a yell that you could have heard half a mile, slung the spade over in the middle of the pond, jump 3 feet in the air, and run down the embankment, yelling and kicking and throwing his arms about in every direction, and at last he fell down on the ground a good distance from the pond. Amos and Uncle Jim were so taken by surprise, at first they just stood still and looked. Amos says he, "The man's gone crazy all at once." Uncle Jim says, "He's having a spell. His father and grandfather before him used to have them spells." Well, they run up to him and found him shaking like a leaf, the cold sweat streaming out of every pore, and gasping and saying, "Take it away, take it away." And all the time he was throwing out his left foot in every direction. Finally, Uncle Jim grabbed hold of his foot, and there was a red and black necktie sticking out of the leg of his pants. He pulled it out and says he, "Why, Sam, what's your Sunday necktie doing up your pants leg?" They said Sam looked at it in a foolish sort of way, and then he fell back laughing and crying at the same time, just like a woman, and it was 5 minutes or more before they could stop him. Uncle Jim brought water and put it on his head, and Amos fanned him with his hat, and at last they got him in such a fix that he could sit up and talk. And says he, "Well, I took off my necktie last night and slung it down on a chair where my everyday pants was laying. When I put my foot in my pants this morning, I must have carried the necktie inside, and by the time I got to the pond, it had worked down, and I thought it was a black snake with red stripes." He started to get up, but his ankle was sprained, and Uncle Jim says, "Well, no wonder, Sam. You jumped about 6 feet when you saw that snake crawling out of your pants leg." And Sam says, "6 feet? I know I'd jump 600 feet, Uncle Jim." Well, they got him to the house and told Millie about it, and she says, "Well, Sam, I'm too sorry for you to laugh at you like Uncle Jim, but I must say this wouldn't have happened if you'd folded up that necktie and put it away in the top drawer." Sam was sitting on the side of the bed rubbing his ankle, and he gave a groan and says he, "Things has come to a fine pass in Kentucky when a sober, God-fearing man like me has to put his necktie in the top drawer to keep from seeing snakes." "I declare to goodness," laughed Aunt Jane as she laid down her trowel and pushed back her calico sunbonnet, "if I never heard anything funny again in this world, I could keep on laughing till I died just over things I recollect. The trouble is there ain't always anybody around to laugh with me. Sam Amos ain't nothing but a name to you, child, but to me, he's just as real as if he hadn't been dead these many years, and I can laugh over the things he used to do the same as if they happened yesterday." Only a name, and I had read it on lichen-covered stone in the old burying ground, but as I walked home through the twilight, I would hardly have been startled if Sam Amos, in the pride of life, had come riding past me on his bay mare, or if Uncle Jim Matthews' voice of cheerful discord had mingled with the spring song of the frog sounding from every marsh and pond. It was Aunt Jane's motto that wherever a weed would grow, a flower would grow, and carrying out this principle of planting, her garden was continually extending its boundaries, and denizens of the garden proper were to be found in every nook and corner of her domain. In the spring, you looked for grass only, and lo, starting up at your feet, like the unexpected joys of life, came the golden daffodil, the paler narcissus, the purple iris, and the red and yellow tulip, flourishing as bravely as in the soil of its native Holland, and for a few sunny weeks the front yard would be a great flower garden. Then blossom and leaf would fade, and you might walk all summer over the velvet grass, never knowing how much beauty and fragrance lay hidden in the darkness of the earth. But when I go back to Aunt Jane's garden, I pass through the front yard and the backyard between rows of lilac, syringas, and honeysuckle. I open the rickety gate and find myself in a genuine old-fashioned garden, the homely, inclusive spot that welcomed all growing things to its hospitable bounds, type of the days when there were no impassable barriers of gold encased between man and his brother man, In the middle of the garden stood a summer house, or arbor, whose crumbling timbers were knit together by interlacing branches of honeysuckle and running roses. The summer house had four entrances opening on four paths that divided the ground into quarter sections occupied by vegetables and small fruits, and around these, like costly embroidery on the hem of a homespun garment, ran a wide border of flowers that blossomed from early May to late November, shifting from one beauty to another as each flower had its little day. To Aunt Jane, every flower in the garden was a human thing with a life story, and close to the summer house grew one historic rose, heroine of an old romance, to which I listened one day as we sat in the arbor, where hundreds of honeysuckle blooms were trumpeting their fragrance on the air. "Grandmother's rose, child, that's all the name it's got," she said in answer to my question. "I reckon you think a fine-looking rose like that ought to have a fine-sounding name, but I never saw anybody yet that knew enough about roses to tell what its right name is. Maybe when I'm dead and gone, somebody'll tack a French name onto it, but as long as it grows in my garden, it'll just be Grandmother's Rose, and this is how it come by the name." My grandfather and grandmother was amongst the first settlers of Kentucky. They come from the Old Dominion, over the Wilderness Road way back yonder, goodness knows when. Did you ever think, child, how curious it was for them men to leave their homes and risk their own lives and the lives of their little children and their wives just to get to a new country? It appears to me they must have been led just like Columbus was when he crossed the big ocean in his little ships. I reckon if the women and children had had their way about it, the bears and wildcats and Indians would be here yet. But a man goes where he pleases, and a woman's got to foller, and that's the way it was with grandfather and grandmother. I've heard mother say that grandmother cried for a week when she found she had to go, and every now and then she'd sob out, "I wouldn't mind so much if I could just take my garden." When they began packing up their things, grandmother took up this rose and put it in an iron kettle and laid plenty of good rich earth around the roots. Grandfather said the load they had to carry was heavy enough without putting in any useless things. But grandmother says she, "If you leave this rose behind, you can leave me too." So the kettle and the rose went. 4 weeks they was on their way, and every time they come to a creek or a river or a spring, grandmother would water her rose, and when they got to their journey's end, before they ever chopped a tree or laid a stone or broke ground, she cut the sod with an axe, and then she took grandfather's hunting knife and dug a hole and planted her rose. Grandfather cut some limbs off a beech tree and drove them into the ground all around it to keep it from being tramped down. And when that was done, grandmother says, "Now build the house so this rose will stand on the right-hand side of the front walk. Maybe I won't die of homesickness if I can sit on my front doorstep and see one flower from my old Virginia garden." Well, grandmother didn't die of homesickness, nor the rose either. The transplanting was good for both of them. She lived to be 90 years old, and when she died, the house wouldn't hold the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that come to the funeral. And here's her rose growing and blooming yet, like there wasn't any such things in the world as old age and death. And every spring, I gather a basketful of these pink roses and lay them on her grave over yonder in the old burying ground. Some folks has family china and family silver that they're mighty proud of. Martha Crawford used to have a big blue and white bowl that belonged to her great-grandmother, and she thought more of that bowl than she did of everything else in the house. Millie Amos had a set of spoons that had been in her family for four generations and was too precious to use. And I've got my family rose, and it's just as dear to me as china and silver are to other folks. I recollect after Father died and the estate had to be divided up and Sister Mary and Brother Joe and the rest of them was laying claim to the claw-footed mahogany table and the old secretary and Mother's cherry sideboard and such things as that. And Brother Joe turned around and says to me, says he, "Is there anything you want, Jane? If there is, speak up and make it known." And I says, the rest of you can take what you want of the furniture, and if there's anything left, that can be my part. If there ain't anything left, there'll be no quarreling, for there's just one thing I want, and that's Grandmother's rose. Well, they all laughed, and Sister Mary says, ain't that just like Jane? And Brother Joe says he, you shall have it, Jane, and further than that, I'll see to the transplanting. That very evening he come over, and I showed him where I wanted the rose to stand. He dug way down into the clay. There's nothing a rose likes better, child, than good red clay, and got a wheelbarrow load of soil from the woods, and we put that in first and set the roots in it and packed them good and firm, first with wood soil and then with clay, watering it all the time. When we got through, I says, now, you pretty thing, you, if you could come all the way from Virginia in an old iron kettle, you surely won't mind being moved from Father's place to mine. Now, you've got to live and bloom for me, same as you did for Mother. You needn't laugh, child. That rose knew just what I said and did just what I told it to do. It looked like everything favored us, for it was early in the spring. Things was beginning to put out leaves, and the next day was cloudy and cool. Then it began to rain, and rained for 36 hours right along. And when the sun come out, Grandmother's rose come out too. Not a leaf on it ever withered, and me and my children and my children's children have gathered flowers from it all these years. Folks say I'm foolish about it, and I reckon I am. I've outlived most of the people I love, but I don't want to outlive this rose. We've both weathered many a hard winter, and two or three times it's been winter killed clean to the ground, and I thought I'd lost it. Honey, it was like losing a child. But there's never been a winter yet hard enough to kill the life in that rose's root, and I trust there never will be while I live, for spring wouldn't be spring to me without Grandmother's rose. Tall, straight, and strong it stood, this oft-transplanted pilgrim rose, and whether in bloom or clothed only in its rich green foliage, you saw at a glance that it was a flower of royal lineage. When spring covered it with buds and full-blown blossoms of pink, the true rose color, it spoke of queen's gardens and king's palaces, and every petal was a palimpsest of song and legend. Its perfume was the attar of rose scent, like that of the roses of India. It satisfied and satiated with its rich potency. And breathing this odor and gazing into its deep wells of color, you had a strange dream of those other pilgrims who left home and friends and journeyed through the perils of a trackless wilderness to plant still farther westward the rose of civilization. To Aunt Jane, there were three epochs in a garden's life: daffodil time, rose time, and chrysanthemum time, and the blossoming of all other flowers would be chronicled under one of these periods, just as we say of historical events that they happened in the reign of this or that queen or empress. But this garden had all seasons for its own, and even in winter there was a deep pleasure in walking its paths and noting how bravely life struggled against death in the frozen bosom of the earth. I once asked her which flowers she loved best. She glanced reprovingly at me over her spectacles. It appears to me, child, you ought to know without asking, she said. Did you ever see as many daffodils in one place before? No, and you never will. I've been planting that flower every spring for 60 years, and I've never got too many of them yet. I used to call them Johnny Jump-Ups till Henrietta told me that their right name was Daffodil. But Johnny Jump-Up suits them best, for it kind of tells how they come up in the spring. The hyacinths and tulips, they hang back till they know it'll be warm and comfortable outside, but these daffodils don't wait for anything. Before the snow's gone, you'll see their leaves pushing up through the cold ground, and the buds come hurrying along, trying to keep up with the leaves, just like they knew that little children and old women like me was waiting and longing for them. Why, I've seen these flowers blooming and the snow falling over them in March, and they didn't mind it a bit. I got my start of daffodils from Mother's garden, and every fall I'd divide the roots up and scatter them out till I got the whole place pretty well sprinkled with them. But the biggest part of them come from the old Harris farm, 3 or 4 miles down the pike. 40 years ago, that farm was sold, and the man that bought it tore things up scandalous. He called it remodeling, I recollect, but it looked more like ruining to me. Old Lady Harris was like myself. She couldn't get enough of these yellow flowers. She had a double row of them all around her garden, and they'd even gone through the fence and come up in the cornfield. And whoever plowed that field had to be careful not to touch them daffodils. Well, as soon as the new man got possession, he begun plowing up the garden, and one evening the news comes up to me that he was throwing away Johnny Jump-Ups by the wagon load. I put on my sunbonnet and went out where Abram was at work in the field, and says I, "Abram, you've got to stop plowing and put the horse to the spring wagon and take me over to the old Harris place." And Abram says he, "Why, Jane, I'd like mighty well to finish this field before night, for it looks like it might rain tomorrow. Is it anything particular you want to go for?" Says I, "Yes, I never was so particular about anything in my life as I am about this. I hear they're plowing up old Lady Harris's garden and throwing the flowers away, and I want to go over and get a wagon load of Johnny Jump-Ups." Abram looked at me a minute like he thought I was losing my senses, and then he burst out laughing, and says he, "Jane, who ever heard of a farmer stopping plowing to go after Johnny Jump-Ups? And who ever heard of a farmer's wife asking him to do such a thing?" I walked up to the plow and begun to unfasten the trace chains, and says I, "Business before pleasure, Abram. If it's going to rain tomorrow, that's all the more reason why I ought to have my Johnny Jump-Ups set today. The plowing can wait till we come back." Of course, Abram gave in when he saw how I wanted the flowers. But he broke out laughing 2 or 3 times while he was hitching up, and says he, "Don't go tell any of the neighbors, Jane, that I stopped plowing to go after a load of Johnny Jump-Ups." When we got to the Harris place, we found the Johnny Jump-Ups lying in a gully by the side of the road, a pitiful sight to anybody that loves flowers and understands their feelings. We loaded up the wagon with the poor things, and as soon as we got home, Abram took his hoe and made a little trench all around the garden, and I set out the Johnny Jump-Ups while Abram finished his plowing. And the next day, the rain fell on Abram's cornfield and on my flowers. Do you see that row of daffodils over yonder by the front fence, child? All leaves and no blossoms? I looked in the direction of her pointing finger and saw a long line of flowerless plants standing like sad and silent guests at the festival of spring. "It's been 6 years since I set them out there," said Aunt Jane, "and not a flower have they had in all that time. Some folks say it's because I moved them at the wrong time of the year. But the same week I moved these, I moved some from my yard to Elizabeth Crawford's, and Elizabeth's bloom every year, so it can't be that. Some folks said the place I had them in was too shady, and I put them right out there where the sun strikes on them till it sets, and still they won't bloom. It's my opinion, honey, that they're just homesick. I believe if I was to take them daffodils back to Aunt Matilda's and plant them in the border where they used to grow alongside the sage and lavender and thyme, that they'd go to blooming again just like they used to. You know how the children of Israel pined and mourned when they was carried into captivity. Well, every time I look at my daffodils, I think of them homesick Israelites asking, 'How can we sing the songs of Zion in a strange land?'" "You needn't laugh, child. A flower's just as human as you and me. Look at that vine yonder, taking hold of everything that comes in its way, like a little child learning to walk. And calycanthus buds, see how you got to hold them in your hands and warm them before they'll give out their sweetness? Just like children that you've got to love and pet before they'll let you get acquainted with them. You see that pink rose over by the fence? Well, that rose didn't do anything but put out leaves the first 2 years I had it. A bud might come once in a while, but it would blast before it was half open. And at last I says to it, says I, 'What is it you want, honey? There's something that don't please you, I know. Don't you like the place you're planted in and the hollyhocks and lilies for neighbors?' And one day I took it up and set it between that white tea and another LaFrance, and it went to blooming right away. It didn't like the neighborhood it was in, you see. And did you ever hear of people disappearing from their homes and never being found anymore? Well, flowers can disappear the same way. The year before I was married, there was a big bed of old pink chrysanthemums growing under the dining room windows at old Dr. Pendleton's. It wasn't a common magenta pink. It was as clear, pretty a pink as that LaFrance rose. Well, I saw them that fall for the first time and the last. The next year, there wasn't any, and when I asked where they'd gone to, nobody could tell anything about them. And ever since then, I've been searching in every old garden in the county, but I've never found them, and I don't reckon I ever will. And there's my roses. Just look at them. Every color a rose can be, and pretty near every kind there is. Wouldn't you think I'd be satisfied? But there's a rose I lost 60 years ago, and the recollecting of that rose keeps me from being satisfied with all I've got. It grew in old Lady Elrod's garden and nowhere else, and there ain't a rose here except grandmother's that I wouldn't give up forever if I could just find that rose again. I've tried many a time to tell folks about that rose, but I can't somehow get hold of the words. I reckon an old woman like me with little or no learning couldn't be expected to tell how that rose looked any more than she could be expected to draw it and paint it. I can say it was yellow. But that word yellow don't tell the color the rose was. I've got all the shades of yellow in my garden, but nothing like the color of that rose. It got deeper and deeper towards the middle, and looking at one of them roses half open was like looking down into a gold mine. The leaves crinkled and curled back towards the stem as fast as it opened, and the more it opened, the prettier it was, like some women that grow better looking the older they grow. Mary Andrews was one of that kind. And when it comes to telling you how it smelled, I'll just have to stop. There never was anything like it for sweetness, and it was different, a different sweetness from any other rose God ever made. I recollect seeing Miss Penelope come in church one Sunday, dressed in white with a black velvet girdle around her waist and a bunch of these roses, buds and half-blown ones and full-blown ones fastened in the girdle, and that bunch of yellow roses was song and sermon and prayer to me that day. I couldn't take my eyes off them, and I thought that if Christ had seen that rose growing in the fields around Palestine, he wouldn't have mentioned lilies when he said Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. I always intended to ask for a slip of it, but I waited too long. It got lost one winter, and when I asked old Lady Elrod about it, she said, "Mistress Parrish, I cannot tell you whence it came nor whither it went." The old lady always used mighty pretty language. Well, honey, them two lost flowers just haunt me. They're like dead children. You know a house may be full of living children, but if there's one dead, a mother will see its face and hear its voice above all the others, and that's the way with my lost flowers. No matter how many roses and chrysanthemums I have, I keep seeing old Lady Elrod's yellow rose dangling from Miss Penelope's girdle and that bed of pink chrysanthemums under Dr. Pendleton's dining room windows. One afternoon, in early June, I stood with Aunt Jane in her garden. It was the time of roses, and in the midst of their opulent bloom stood the tall white lilies, handmaidens to the queen. Here and there over the warm earth, old-fashioned pinks spread their prayer rugs, on which a worshiper might kneel and offer thanks for life and spring. And towering over all, rows of many-colored hollyhocks flamed and glowed in the light of the setting sun, like the stained glass windows of some old cathedral. Across the flowery expanse, Aunt Jane looked wistfully toward the evening skies, beyond whose stars and clouds we place that other world called heaven. "I'm like my grandmother, child," she said presently. "I know I've got to leave this country some day soon and journey to another one, and the only thing I mind about it is giving up my garden. When John looked into heaven, he saw gold streets and gates of pearl, but he didn't say anything about gardens. I like what he says about no sorrow, nor crying, nor pain, and God wiping away all tears from their eyes. That's pure comfort. But if I could just have Abram and the children again in my old home and my old garden, I'd be willing to give up the gold streets and glass sea and pearl gates. The loves of earth and the homes of earth, no apocalyptic vision can come between these and the earth-born human heart. Life is said to have begun in a garden, and if here was our lost paradise, may not the paradise we hope to gain through death be, to the lover of nature, another garden and a new earth, girdled by four soft-flowing rivers and watered by mists that arise in the night to fall on the face of the sleeping world, where all we plant shall grow unblighted through winterless years, and they who inherit it go with white garments and shining faces and say at morn and noon and eve, my soul is like a watered garden. The end. Thanks so much for listening to the Quilt Fiction Podcast. Today's episode brings us to the end of Aunt Jane of Kentucky by Eliza Calvert Hall. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. For more about the Quilt Fiction Podcast, go to our website, quiltfiction.com. And while you're there, please sign up for our newsletter so you can keep up to date with whatever project we're working on now. Thanks again. I hope to see you soon. Take care.